social media for EMS, hidden paramedic costs, getting yourself EMS cachet, and we'll look at what we can do for the treatment of penetrating and crush injuries in the field. If that's what you're looking for, you found it right here on this week's episode of the MedicCast.
Transmitters? We don't need no stinking transmitters!
This is the MedicCast, a podcast for EMS providers by EMS providers, featuring EMS news, products, tips, tricks, and commentary. So grab your gear and glove up. Here's today's show with the PodMedic, Jamie Davis.
Well, good day and welcome to this week's episode of the MedicCast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the PodMedic, and it's great to see you all here this week. I'd like to welcome you to this week's show. In this week's EMS news items, we're going to look at several news stories that discuss the hidden challenges and costs of being an EMS provider. Then in this week's special tip segment, we have another interview from the Physio Control Podcast Studio at EMS Today back in February. Dr. Ed Dixon, GEMS Medical Director, sat down with me to talk about penetrating and crush injury management in EMS. Do you know what to do and what best practices are to handle these types of injuries? Well, we're going to find out what he thinks later on in the show, after the news. Before we get to that, though, I do want to make sure you're doing a couple of things. I want you to head over and check out the links and additional information over at mediccast.com/blog. There's a show notes link at the top of the page. You can click that link. It'll take you right to the most recent episodes. You can scroll down and go to previous episodes if you want, but I want you to look for information that we talk about here on the show and make sure you follow the links and understand what it means to you and your practice. Take some time. Follow those links. Get the information, and then look at your own protocols and see how it applies to your own EMS practice. If you want to get back in touch with me, maybe you've done all that and you need to get in touch with me and have a question, you can do that. I'd love to hear from you. Shoot me an email to podmedic@mac.com with your comments, questions, ideas for future episodes. Maybe you have somebody you want me to interview from your system that's doing something cool in EMS. Either way, I work hard to respond back to the emails that come in and I'll get back to you as well. So please, please keep those emails coming. Also, if you're an iPhone, Android, Windows Phone, or Windows 8 user, check out the free MedicCast app from your device's store. It's there for you, and we want you to use it, and it's absolutely free. That's enough contact info. Let's go ahead and get on into the rest of the show. It's coming right up here with the news. Kicking off the EMS news this week, let's take a look at two studies mentioned over at EMSworld.com about the use of social media in emergency medicine to promote best practices worldwide for things like medical blogs and podcasts. The studies examine the FOAMED conference movement. FOAMED is F-O-A-M-E-D. It stands for Free Open Access Medical Education, and it's an online movement to have free online access to research and medical best practice. Now, in some cases, it's in direct opposition to the continued journal-centered paywall medical research access that is the norm for much of the research in medicine. Blogs, podcasts, and other social media forums circumvent this pay-only system by publishing the information that's free to the entire audience. They get it out to their followers, their Facebook friends, whoever the case may be, and they get it to the end users who then can apply that information to their patient care. One of the studies in the article focused on how to use social media to discuss newly released research, and they actually improved the release of information and spread it much more quickly. The journal Annals of Emergency Medicine worked with the FOAMED site, Academic Life in Emergency Medicine, to examine the reach of social media for medical information. They found that when they hosted an online discussion using social media like Twitter and Facebook on medical tests to diagnose pulmonary embolism, they got an additional 1,000 page views from over 50 different countries in 2 weeks after the event. Certainly, social media pushed this information out faster to the intended audience of medical professionals. I see similar things at various EMS conferences I attend. I'm there with other EMS podcasters, people like Chris Montero from the EMS Garage, and we see the information we interview people about in our podcast studio shared and re-released over social media many times faster than we could probably achieve on our own or through some kind of print media. This type of movement is going to continue to spread. You can follow FOAMED updates by following the hashtag FOAMED and get the latest and greatest in free medical and health research delivered to you by things like Twitter. Next up is a great article I picked up from Australia about being a paramedic. And it's written not by a paramedic, but by the son of a rural paramedic there. And it talks about the price of being a paramedic and how proud of his father the author is. One of the stats that leapt out at me from the article was the stat that one paramedic is killed every 2 years in Australia and 30 are seriously injured in transportation-related accidents. Sound familiar? The author hears sirens going by, he thinks about his father, and he thinks about paramedics, and he wonders if they are going to arrive safely or not. Now, I like this look at EMS from the outside, based on the impression of our own family members. They are proud of us, and they're inspired by us, but they're also afraid for us, too. And that tells me something that I think we forget sometimes when we go through our mantra each week here on the show of Scene Safety, BSI. We need to remember who we are coming home for at the end of the day. Our wives, husbands, children, siblings, significant others, and friends, they all want to see us come home safely. And we need to keep that in mind as we go about our work each day. Are we driving safely? Are we going safely even when running lights and sirens? Are we showing due regard for traffic signals and laws? You know, at the end of the day, my wish for each and every one of you is to have you come home safely and have a job well done with patients well cared for. That's why I end the show each week with the words Scene Safety, BSI. Some may think it's a joke or just a tagline for my podcast, but to me, it's so much more. It's a reminder for you to be safe, not just some of the time, but all of the time, on the job and at home. It's a hope that someday, maybe your loved one will be able to write a prideful article about you that's just not just some sad obituary. Finally, in our EMS news for paramedics and EMTs this week, I bring you a look at a column over at EMSworld.com on the site there, written by my good friend Jim Hoffman. Jim's a paramedic educator, podcaster, and entrepreneur who puts together an amazing set of learning tools for medic students over at TurboMedic. You can look it up and Google it and find it there, or go to GetTurboMedic.com. Jim talks in his column about building your EMS cachet. Now, what's cachet? Well, I found a definition that says it means superior status or prestige, a sign of approval. Getting this kind of prestige is not about bragging rights. It's really a way to say, I'm just doing my job. I'm not better than everybody else. I'm just doing my job. And it's earned through action, not words. It refers to the silent respect some of our colleagues have for us, or maybe we have for some of them. The paramedic who takes control of the scene by their mere presence, the one we all listen to and respect. We all want to develop that cachet, but it starts out by doing your job day in, day out, without complaint. And it continues by raising the bar for the medical care you strive to reach each day. It starts by having professionalism on and off the job. How do you carry yourself in places like social media or in public and when you're not working? Do you strive to lead by examples to encourage others to do the same, working for cooperation rather than divisiveness? Well, then I think you're on your way to getting cachet. I want to thank Jim for bringing up this topic. I think it's a great topic to talk about because it really deals with the professionalism that we strive for. Check out his article and read his thoughts on it as well, and let me know what you think of this concept of EMS cachet. I look for your comments here on this site and in the article for this episode, or you can head over and check out medicast.com/blog. At EMS Today back in February, I got the chance to interview Dr. Ed Dixon, GEMS medical director. Dr. Dixon talked with me about penetrating and crush injuries and how EMS providers should prepare to manage these specific types of trauma patients. Check out this segment from the Physiocontrol podcast studio. And I want to thank again Physiocontrol, EMS Today, and GEMS for having the podcast studio in their exhibit hall and letting us be there and do these amazing interviews. Find all the segments we shot from the conference here on the MedicCast over time or over at the blog at ProMed Network at blog.promednetwork.com. Hi, Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic here from the MedicCast and from EMS Today 2015. We're here in our podcast studio sponsored by Physio-Control. We appreciate their support of our programming and all of the things we're doing here in the podcast studio at EMS Today this year. I have Dr. Ed Dixon with us here, and we're going to talk a little bit about penetrating injuries and crush injuries, which is something that we all kind of need to bone up on a little bit and refresh our knowledge about. And before we do that, though, tell us a little bit about your background and who you are and where you are.
Well, where I am now is I'm a professor of emergency medicine at the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia, Level 1 Trauma Center, so we see a lot of these sorts of cases. My background is I kind of rose through the ranks as an EMT, a firefighter paramedic, eventually got my way into medical school, and now I've been practicing emergency medicine, for about 20 years out of residency at this point.
Yep. That's fantastic.
Yeah,
I like to see EMTs that have been paramedics that have come up through and are ER docs. I really seem like I have an affinity to work with them and alongside them, so that's great.
Yeah, it's always interesting because I restart my national registry paramedic every 2 years, and people look at me like, what are you doing? You're a doctor. You're board-certified emergency medicine, board-certified EMS. Why are you still keeping your medic? Because it's real important to me. It's where I came from.
That's great to kind of recognize your roots and continue to do that.
Absolutely.
Go jump through those hoops along with the rest of us.
Exactly.
Yeah.
All the changes.
So let's talk a little bit about penetrating injury, and then we'll move into crush injury. What are some of the key things? You're speaking on that here at the conference. What are some of the key things that a paramedic or an EMT even need to keep in mind when they look at somebody with penetrating trauma?
Yeah, I think one of the interesting things here that we really kind of picked up on, we did the lecture a little while ago today, and the diversity of our attendees here. You know, we have people who work in urban centers, see a lot of penetrating trauma. They have a conversation with someone from the state of Maine who sees it every 5 years, every 10 years.
Right.
So there's a great diversity in the frequency which our providers encounter at. But the basics are always the same. And there are a couple of things that are just absolutely essential. And the first is surviving the encounter. You know, there's violence, there's injury, and scene safety is absolutely paramount in this sort of situation. The coordination with law enforcement, never going into a scene, staging outside of gun range until law enforcement has secured the scene and made it safe. And in rural areas, that can be a real problem because it could be a long way before the trooper or the sheriff gets there.
Right.
EMS is there ahead of time. And in the urban environment, sometimes it's a lot more hectic, a lot more complex scenes as well. So clearly the big take-home message that we have to always remind people on, especially those who don't see a lot, because a lot of, wow, it's a shooting, let's go, sort of thing, is that this is all about your safety. The other thing that was interesting today, we asked the audience, we polled them, we said, well, how many of you wear ballistic vests on duty? And we probably had maybe 300-400 people in the room, and there were only about 5 hands went up about providers wearing ballistic vests.
There's not that many agencies out there that are doing it, just a few. I just saw a report that a city of Charlotte in South Carolina was actually looking at getting bulletproof vests for their service.
Yeah, it's interesting. I live in suburban Philadelphia, and we have had the Newcastle County paramedic students rotating through our firehouse. And even as students, they're wearing their ballistic vests.
Yes, they are. Newcastle County does.
Yeah,
I'm actually just down the road in Rising Sun, Maryland.
Okay, sure. Yeah.
In Cecil County, so we interact with these Newcastle County medics quite a bit.
Yeah, and I think real leaders like Chief Tan, who's there, is very savvy about those sorts of things. It's really that where you want to be. That.
So, what are your thoughts? Just kind of on a tangent here.
Yeah.
Should medics be wearing vests? Is this something that should become part of our standard uniform for more organizations?
Well, it's hard because it's a very expensive resource. It is well in excess of $1,000 to outfit every medic with it. So, in a lot of places, it's cost prohibitive. It's very hard to study because the N is so small. You don't see a lot of shootings, but you do always save one life. And as far as I'm concerned, that's an N of 1,000, that one life saved. I think that in the proper urban environments, I think in the proper suburban environments, if there's a significant basic substrate of violence and penetrating trauma, I think it's something that's appropriate. It's interesting, I was in New Zealand not too long ago, and they wear stab-proof vests.
Wow.
They don't wear bulletproof vests because a lot of the violence they see there is tribal violence where they're all hand-driven objects. So their police officers don't wear ballistic vests, but they wear stab-proof vests.
Interesting.
So I think you really have to modify that based on the environment. And it's not that any of us at any given time anywhere in the United States could be a victim of violence and have that risk. But I think to a certain extent based on economic factors and things like that, I think I kind of pick your argument where you're going to make a big stand for it. If you're still trying to get an ambulance that can keep on the road, maybe that's where the funding has to be versus buying ballistic vests. It's not a black and white issue. There's a lot of gray there. And we'd always like to err on the side of everyone gets one, but it's a realistic view. Not everyone can have one.
Yeah. So we've thinking about scene safety. We've done the things we're supposed to do. We're staging. Police have secured the scene. We're coming in. We approach the patient. What's the next step?
Well, I think even before you get off the truck and you're moving in, you're thinking about, I had a shooting just about 3 weeks ago at home, and I was staged with the EMS units, and you're thinking in that moment, waiting for that call to say it's clear, move on in, but you should be thinking about even before you leave your rig, what you're taking in. All too often is that sense to rush in, grab your primary bag, go on out and figure out what's going on, and you don't think about grabbing your reef stretcher, for instance,
right.
Because we know scene time is critical here. The literature that's coming out about higher survivability with police transports versus EMS transports, it's not because they're providing better care, they're getting them there faster. So from the moment we think about that call, heading in with that primary bag, heading in with the reef stretcher, so your thought is about extrication and getting them out and getting going to where they need to be for definitive
care. So not
care.
Staying on the scene a long time, backboarding, collaring, and doing all that stuff. We really just need to scoop and go.
Right, and we know the literature now, too, specifically to backboarding and collaring, we know there's really no indication
right.
anymore to backboard or collar penetrating trauma.
But I said that because I know a lot of organizations, you know, penetrating trauma above the waist, we need,
yep.
we need to backboard
yep.
them. We need, that's a lot of wasted time.
It's a lot of wasted time. I think the reef stretcher is your best weapon to get someone out with. And I think that, you know, I think there are some exceptions to the no backboard, no collar thing. You know, the person gets shot, falls off the roof, is unconscious, you can't assess the C-spine,
right.
or they have a significant distracting injury. The rules we're playing by with everybody now. I think that's an important issue. But as you said, wasting that time to strap someone aboard, you know, KED, a mobile, whatever it happens to be, that's not what this is all about at this point. So again, from the moment you get there, the concept, we're moving off this scene. No dilly-dallying, starting the IV. It's really about the airway, breathing, and circulation inside, controlling hemorrhage, maintaining the airway, ventilating as necessary, and getting going with the patient.
So we transport them. We're going to do all our key interventions on the road once we've done those life-saving interventions
yeah.
on the scene. Get them into the back of the unit. We're going to start our IVs then transport, and then we need to get them to the definitive care center, and that's where we next fall down, I would imagine.
Well, there's a lot of challenges. I think that, you know, one of the things we talk about in the lecture is always presume the worst. Always presume that any injury, any pain training injury is the real deal. You know, and that's why the trauma, national trauma triage protocols talk about proximal to the elbow, proximal to the knee. That's, even if it looks like a nothing, it's still a major wound, and we got to be very attentive to those issues. I think that's exciting right now. In the last 2 years or so, national organizations, physician-based organizations, National Association of Physicians, the American College of Surgeons, Committee on Trauma, have really become very aggressive in thinking about the pre-hospital environment. So we've got very good evidence-based guidelines now from those groups in regards to who gets a tourniquet, who doesn't get a tourniquet, who gets hemostatic dressings, you know, because that was always kind of floating out there. What do? Do I use my tourniquet? I've got this new thing that's okay to use
right.
now. Like my mom told me never to use one, but it's okay now to use it because
yep.
it's not a dangerous thing. It's a
right.
lifesaver. I got this new thing called hemostatic dressing. When do I use that? To kind of coordinate those sorts of things. And that's exciting. And then the concept of junctional wounding, which is really an outcrop of what we've seen in Afghanistan and Iraq, those deep wounds
right.
high in the groin, deep in the axilla, at the base of the neck, then nothing's going to work that we really have, at which point we're talking about maybe just taking a huge wad of hemostatic dressing, putting your hand in there and just trying to hold pressure as best you can until you can get to definitive care, and that may be your only job. You know,
yeah.
so that's very exciting. The other thing we talked about today, which I think is kind of cutting-edge stuff, which is clearly coming down to EMS because its efficacy is in the first 1 to 3 hours of care, is the use of TXA. Using the product TXA, which is a very inexpensive anti-fibrinolytic product. So the point is here, it fights the body's normal desire to break down clots.
Okay.
And the expert, you know, the models looking at large studies internationally, you know, 25 or so thousand people or 22,000 people in the study, about a 2% survival rate, increased survival rate if for people who are obviously in hypovolemic shock or bleeding who have a mechanism.
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty exciting. And even those,
and, you know, people say, well, 2%, no, it doesn't sound like a lot. But no, that in 100 people, that's two more people that have lived.
Right.
That's a significant number.
Right. And in 20,000 people, do the math.
Yeah.
You know, and it really does matter. And it seems like also in our experience, even with our most sophisticated trauma care, where patients are receiving massive transfusions, they're getting platelets, they're getting fresh frozen plasma, they're getting unit upon unit upon unit of blood. It's even more effective in that realm. And the key thing here is it's only effective if you give them the first 1 to 3 hours. So it's clearly a tool for us in EMS. For our rural providers, we got to think about it being out there. It's only a hundred and some dollars a dose.
Okay.
It's not outrageous. It's an intravenous thing. You give, you know, a gram of it over 10 minutes, slow IV push, and then you continue in the trauma center. We have it on our helicopter program at PennStar in Philadelphia. We have about 6 aircraft. We actually are kind of strange how we use it. We have to pick, if we're going to use it, we have to pick the right patient, but then we look at where's the patient going, because some trauma centers don't use it yet. I'm not going to have my crews give it to arrive at a trauma center that's not going to continue
right.
the infusion, so you have to kind of modify as you use it. But I think that's a very exciting, with high impact pre-hospital care that can really make a difference in these patients. So I think
on
it's kind
the horizon,
exciting. Yeah,
new,
I think it's really exciting.
Coming in.
So in 5 years we'll have this talk and they didn't say, yep, we were right or we were totally wrong. Like
we'll
all good evidence,
out.
Right? And
we'll
have to
yeah.
see where it goes.
Well,
but for now,
for
it's
now,
out there.
It looks promising.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
So let's shift gears, look at crush injury, which is a different type of severe injury that we need to be really aware of.
Yeah.
We've seen, you know, whether it's from a collapse and being trapped or something of that nature, or crush injury from even a blast or something like that, I would imagine. So how do you define a crush injury?
Well, I think there are two major definitions that everyone has to kind of wrap their heads around. One issue is a crush injury, which is really the effect at a local level you get in that arm or that leg that's compressed and entrapped. That local milieu of things that go on, such as compartment syndrome, wounding, hemorrhage, those sorts of things. So that really is the crush injury. And to that, you know, that's a limb-threatening emergency, potentially. You know, you lose an extremity over that sort of thing. But really the more complex sort of milieu here is crush syndrome, which is not what happens when it's crushed, but when you release the limb and you get these systemic manifestations.
All that junk, all that cellular nonsense, just
all that evil humor
the body.
Sitting in there, all that acidosis, all those vasoactive products, it's that which is actually truly a life-threatening emergency that happens that fast. So I think a lot of what we talk about in our lectures, you know, is educating, talk about what crush injury is, what crush syndrome is, but then broadening and realizing that, you know, things change very rapidly in those scenes, and it has a lot to do with reperfusion. Once that arm gets released, what are the consequences? And that's really an area where, again, we don't see a lot of it. Probably most people see more pantrain trauma than they really see these big crush syndromes, that you really need to have your head screwed on correctly. In fact, what really spurred me to do this talk was I got a phone call at about 7 o'clock in the morning, woke me up from one of my rescue squads saying, we got this guy, he's trapped. And they said, should we give him bicarb? Should we give him calcium? And also I had to turn my head on and go, I don't do a lot of those. So let me focus my head. What should I be ordering here? Because I don't see a lot of that, even in a big urban trauma center. We simply don't see a lot. So it's a much more lower sort of frequency event, but very complex in a place where ALS care is very important, as is BLS care in that scenario, to try to optimize survival.
So what are those next steps? We free the limb, we get that reperfusion happening, now we're going to have this sudden flood of toxins back into the systemic circulation.
Well, I think we need to slow it down a little bit, because obviously scene safety is a big part of this. We talked about that with pantry trauma, right?
Obviously, they're in a situation, we don't want to be climbing down into the trench with them without the proper tools and anything like that.
The scene is made safe, and that's critical. And there's a lot of time sitting around twiddling your thumbs waiting for that to happen. That can go on for quite a while. But the other thing is, there's a sense that once the scene is secured, pop them out, let's go. But in reality, a lot of the interventions we can do to prevent some of the sequelae of the crush syndrome occurring, if we just take a couple minutes, once we get access to the person, once the patient's in the hole still, before we release them, if we can get IV access, we can start to slam with a liter or two of fluid. And it's interesting, the CDC specifically recommends in those syndromes where you've got crush injury and your potential crush syndrome, and we tend to see that after about 2-3 hours, you're in that window. 10 minutes, 15 minutes, it's not going to be there, but 2 hours certainly, and you know, 3-4 for sure, you're going to start to see that sort of stuff. But the CDC now is a specific recommendation. If you can't get to that limb before it's released to get IV fluid in somebody, put a tourniquet on it.
Okay.
So they
that makes
say,
sense.
Right? So it makes perfect sense, right? So they say, if you can't hydrate to keep all those, to dilute all those evil humors when they're about to hit the central circulation, then don't let them out. Don't let the ghost out of the bag. Well, we can extricate the person, let's get that tourniquet on, let's crank it down, now let's get them out, now let's fluid resuscitate them, and then we can release the tourniquet. Who the heck cares? It's been stuck in there for 4 hours.
What's another 15, 20
exactly.
minutes? Get them to the hospital and let the hospital work
right.
on getting that. Be prepared for that release with all the facilities and resources they have.
Exactly. And in the meantime, you're starting fluids, you're monitoring the heart,
and stuff
like that.
You're getting the process going.
Right.
So
but again, you're not just saying, oh, they're out, quick, get them out. There's some time to repair. You got a moment there. And that is a real issue of careful coordination with the incident commander. Because the incident commander is thinking all about getting them out.
You've got fire there. They're involved in the actual rescue portion of it. You've got to make sure the medical command is actively involved in the process.
And you're whispering in the ear, saying, I know you're going to have them out in a second, but I want to get in that hole before we pop them. I want to get this line in. I've got to give them a couple liters of fluid if I can. If they're assuming they're stable enough to wait for that time, so it's a constant kind of that unified command model of having good interaction there.
But I haven't, you know, talking about crush syndrome, I haven't heard that thought of putting a tourniquet on the limb and controlling the release for later if you have to, if you can't get the fluids on board.
But you know what's interesting too is that it's kind of problematic on the other side too. You've done all the right things, you put the tourniquet on. What happens if you roll into a trauma center with a tourniquet on somebody? And they go, what's this doing here? What are you thinking? So again, when you get to the trauma center, despite you may, again, trauma surgeons don't see a lot of it.
No.
When you walk through doors, you can say, doc, listen, this tourniquet's on for this specific reason. Please don't take it off. You understand why I put this on. This is our guideline because we only got 500 cc's of fluid in this guy. He needs another liter or two before I would think about releasing that. And so, you know, and again, because you may catch the trauma surgeon off guard or the ED attending off guard or the ED resident off guard because they think a tourniquet, I don't see any bleeding here.
Right.
There are abrasions on that arm. What are these guys thinking?
Yeah.
So I think that's another important part of communication.
And you're right. You have to communicate. And that's something that I'm a big proponent of is, getting, if you have an opportunity, getting to know your ER docs in your community and getting to know how to talk properly to your trauma center so that they know what you're sending in, they know what to expect.
Right.
You give them that heads up, because of suspected crush injury, I have applied a tourniquet.
Right.
caution is suggested before you release it.
Yep.
And then
yep.
they've got the heads up. They know what's coming in the door.
Right.
That's so important.
Yeah, absolutely. Communication. I mean, think about all the bad things that ever happened, all the things, you know, malcurrence that happened, bad things that we didn't know. It's all about communication.
Well, Ed, I want to thank you very much for coming on the show.
Thanks for the time.
This has been a great talk. I think we could probably talk about this for a lot longer.
We can go on for a long time.
Yeah, we could. But thank you for coming on. If people want to reach out to you, where can they find you out in the wild? Are you available?
So I'm on the web through the Hospital of the University of Pennsylvania, Department of Emergency Medicine. I'm on that website. Yep.
Fantastic.
You can find my link there.
I'll make sure I put a link in the show notes for this episode to that site, and they can find you if they have any questions or maybe want to have you come in and talk about this.
Great. My pleasure.
Great.
Thanks so much.
And I want to thank all of you for checking out this episode here at EMS Today 2015. We want to thank GEMS, EMS Today, and of course Physio-Control for sponsoring our podcast studio and giving us the opportunity to bring people like Dr. Dixon here to you here in the show. So check it out. More available for you over at medicast.tv. That's going to wrap up this week's episode of the MedicCast. I want to thank all of you for checking out the show this week, and of course, remind you to follow up on all of the information you get in this week's show over at the MedicCast blog. That's at medicast.com/blog. Over there, you'll find a show notes link at the top of the page. Go ahead and take a moment and follow up on all of the information and links to news items and more you find there each week. You can also sign up for our email newsletter that'll bring you those links directly into your email inbox each week if you want. There's a form on the right-hand side of the page. Just go ahead and fill that out and you can get the MedicCast newsletter for yourself. I also welcome your comments and suggestions by email. So if you want to get back in touch with me, shoot me an email to podmedic@mac.com. Send in your ideas for news links, ideas for future show topics or interviews, whatever comments you might have. I really do look forward to hearing from you, and I'll make sure I get back to you. I work hard to respond back to every email that comes in, so please keep those emails coming. If you want to catch up with me on social media and some of the pages and sites out there, you can find me at most places under the handle Podmedic. So you can catch me over at Twitter at twitter.com/podmedic or Facebook at facebook.com/podmedic. Friend or follow me over there. Also, don't forget to check out our MedicCast Facebook page. We now have over 5,000 followers, so head over to facebook.com/medicCast. Click the like button on the top of the page and join the community over there. That's going to wrap up this week's episode of the MedicCast. Please make sure you spread the word and share the MedicCast with your colleagues and students and friends in the EMS world. I'll be back here each week with new episodes, new interviews, news items, tips, and more every Monday morning to start off your EMS week. Tell somebody else about the MedicCast today. I'm Jamie Davis, the PodMedic. It's time to close out the show. Don't forget to thank our sponsors, and remember, folks, Scene Safety, BSI.